Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Institute for Philosophy and Religion titled Faith and Doubt Among the Virtues. Our speaker is Jennifer Hurt, Gilbert L. Stark Professor of Christian Ethics and Associate Dean of Academic Affairs at Yale Divinity School. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Institute for Philosophy and Religion Director David Eckel.
We welcome Professor Jennifer Hurt, the Gilbert Stark Professor of Christian Ethics and Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at Yale Divinity School. Professor Hurt is the author of Religion and Faction in Hume's Moral Philosophy, and also of a book called Putting on Virtue, The Legacy of the Splendid Vices. This is the book that I'm holding in my hand right here. Her primary interests are in early modern and modern moral thought, classical and contemporary virtue ethics, and contemporary Protestant social ethics and political theology. In our institute seminar last week, the graduate students and the undergrads read the first half of Putting on Virtue. And I think I won't falsify your reactions if I say that all of us agreed this book is a challenging and immensely lucid and persuasive and intelligent exploration of the dilemmas involved when the classical tradition of virtue ethics is drawn into the setting of Christian reflection about what it means to live a good life. Faith is one of the theological virtues, so it's essential, I think, it is essential to start thinking about faith and about doubt by placing virtue, by placing faith in the context of the virtues. There could not be a more perfect person to help us do this than Professor Hurt. She's going to be speaking to us tonight about faith and doubt, among the virtues. Please join me in welcoming Professor Hurt to Boston University.
Thank you so much, David, for that wonderful introduction. It's really a pleasure to be here at BU. This is my first visit to the campus. And for many years, I've been receiving these brochures that discuss the offerings of the Institute seminar for the year, and they always look fascinating, and I always wish that I could come and be in the audience. And so it's a special honor to be on the roster for this year. So why should we frame an exploration of faith and doubt in terms of the virtues? And if we do that, is doubt always the vice that corresponds to the virtue of faith? Can doubt itself ever be a virtue, or faith a vice? I think most basically the wisdom of approaching faith and doubt through the lens of the virtues lies in that it moves us away from thinking about faith and doubt as isolated acts. It encourages us to think about them as matters of character, as stable dispositions to act in certain ways. For virtue is just a stable disposition to act well, and in so doing, to become perfected as an agent. But what is the special place of faith and of doubt, potentially, among the virtues? I want today, in very broad strokes, to suggest the following narrative. Once upon a time in the Christian West, faith was unambiguously a virtue, and doubt was not. In the early modern period, doubt was held up as a virtue, and faith began to fall under suspicion. Today, faith can again be a virtue, but when it is, a disposition to appropriate doubt is an aspect of it, not a contrast to it. Obviously, this is a pretty large story, so I won't be doing more than sketching it here. And I'll spend most of the time laying out in some detail Thomas Aquinas' understanding of the virtue of faith. This 13th century medieval scholastic theologian develops a remarkably nuanced and insightful account, and the point of spending time with it is so that we can avoid too quickly concluding that it has nothing to say to us today. In fact, I'd argue that any defensible virtue of faith for our own context, certainly, but not only one conceived in Christian terms, will owe a great deal to Aquinas. After unpacking Aquinas on faith, I then discuss in very brief compass significant shifts that took place in the 16th century in relation to the disruptions introduced by the discovery of the New World and by the Reformation, and then in the 17th century by Descartes' rationalism and Locke's empiricism. Concluding by way of a brief engagement with 20th century theologian Karl Barth's understanding of confession, I'll offer a few thoughts on where all of this leaves us today. But first, a few words on the virtues as such. Human beings need the virtues in order to flourish because we are, on the one hand, moral agents capable of acting for reasons. We can stand back from any instinct or desire and ask whether it gives us adequate reason to act, whether that luscious hamburger is to be eaten or whether it is to be refused as belonging to someone else or perhaps as resulting from factory farming practices. Our actions can thus be our own in a fuller sense than is possible when a non-rational animal acts on instincts. On the other hand, we are finite moral agents. Our character as agents and the integrity of that character are not a given. We do not necessarily act well. In order to have a stable identity, we need habits to take the place of instincts in lending coherence to our agency. A beaver will industriously chop down trees and drag them into place. A human lumberjack may linger in bed too long or call in sick in order to go fishing. In order for our habits to be good and help to constitute us as good, these habits must embody a reflective grasp of what is good. Attention to the virtues has exploded since the latter half of the 20th century, birthed in a context of dissatisfaction with the reigning options in moral philosophy. Deontology focused on actions that conform to duty and obligation, and utilitarianism focused on actions that maximize the greatest good for the greatest number. For no matter how excellent the principles one has devised, they nevertheless have to be applied. Someone has to discern that this particular situation calls for the application of that principle. And why? Is this termination of life a murder? Is this lifelong sexual friendship a marriage? This discernment requires practical wisdom, which is a virtue. Where it began to be asked amidst all the attention to isolated actions and decision procedures, was there room for considerations of character, intentions, emotions, ethical perception and discernment, human flourishing, friendship, moral exemplars, moral education? Where in all this intense focus on what to do in the context of some pressing moral dilemma, with a philosopher sitting on the trolley hurtling toward various tracks with various numbers of people on them, where in all this was there space to consider what life is worth living? Moreover, there was growing recognition of the fact that how we act in such moments of decision will reflect how we perceive the ethically salient features of a situation, and that this in turn is shaped by our character, by how we have been formed, and hence by the social practices and communities and traditions we inhabit. I may be keenly aware that in some situation proper procedures have been followed, or perhaps oblivious to that, but aware that someone's feelings have been hurt. Even in merely learning how to use such thick descriptive terms as generous, cowardly, or rash, I am learning at the very same time how to make certain moral judgments, judgments of character. So the initial impetus for a retrieval of virtue ethics came not directly from a conviction that what was missing from the conversation were the virtues, but from worries over an excessive narrowing of ethical reflection. But a natural place to turn for a more holistic ethical discourse was to the ancient Greek philosophers with their rich discussions of the virtues and the good life, and to Christian thinkers who appropriated and baptized their thought. Initially, the lion's share of attention fell to Aristotle among the ancients and to Aquinas among the medievals. Gradually, the project of constructive retrieval has broadened to include all of the ancient philosophical schools, notably Plato and the Stoics, and fuller attention in the Christian tradition to to Augustine, to a host of other patristic thinkers and medieval thinkers, as well as moderns from Hume to Edwards, and now even Kant. There's growing attention that the first half of the 20th century was exceptional in its lack of attention to the virtues. With agreement on the importance of the virtues comes a host of other potential points of disagreement. What virtues are there? Is there a determinate number? Are they the same in all times and places? How are they to be individuated? How are they related? How are they acquired? While Aristotle discussed a host of virtues, the four Platonic virtues of courage, temperance, justice, and prudence held a special place in both Greek and patristic Christian thought. It was Ambrose, Augustine's teacher, who dubbed them cardinal or hinge virtues. Patristic thinkers relying on Paul and the letter to the Corinthians added the theological virtues of faith, hope, and love. The patristics generally regarded all of the virtues as infused by God's grace, regarded love, not the Socratic virtue of wisdom, as the key organizing virtue. It was only centuries later that medieval scholastics developed a scheme that clearly separated the civic virtues from the theological virtues, distinguishing them both by mode of acquisition and by the end, goal, or purpose to which they are directed. Thomas Aquinas's account of the virtues, which incorporated a recovered Aristotelian ethics into a received Christian tradition heavily shaped by Stoicism, is widely regarded as the best articulation of this scheme. It is one that has had considerable staying power, particularly though not exclusively within the Catholic tradition. Humanly acquired virtues direct us to our end insofar as this is grasped by our natural faculties. These virtues assist us in flourishing as the kind of creatures we are, rational, embodied, social creatures. But God calls humankind to a higher, supernatural end, one to which our natural faculties are inadequate. The happiness of the beatific vision of God, of knowing and loving God as God truly is. Only divinely infused virtues, virtues poured into the soul by grace, as it were, can direct us properly toward that end, so that our actions assist us in reaching it. This is all the more so because the fall has damaged our natural capacities, and so we are no longer capable even of fully developing the acquired virtues. To make matters even more complex, Aquinas argued that the theological virtues do not comprise all of the infused virtues. Human beings are in need as well of infused moral virtues, so that all aspects of our agency can be directed toward our end of friendship with God. So now, we in the modern West, I think, typically think of faith in one of two ways. Either we take faith to be any kind of trust or conviction, or confidence, is when we say of someone who supported us through a difficult time that she had faith in me, or of someone who suffers through difficult medical treatment, he had faith in modern medicine. In this sense, we have faith in the people and things in which we make significant investments, for which we take risks. Alternatively, we think of faith in specifically religious terms as acceptance of religious doctrine, the official teachings of a religion. For Aquinas, though, faith is one of the three theological virtues, together with hope and love. Aquinas believes that natural human reason, apart from faith, can know God, but only know God in a highly limited and indirect way, essentially as an unknown to which the human mind is ordered. Only by grasping faith as an infused virtue do certain puzzling features of Aquinas' account fall into place. The virtue of faith is a habit that disposes its possessor to acts of faith. Faith is distinct from both science and opinion while sharing features of each. In fact, Aquinas treats faith in Aristotelian fashion as a mean between science and opinion. Like science, it is a form of certainty. Unlike science, faith does not see its object. It can offer no demonstrative proofs of the truth of what it believes. In this respect, faith is more like opinion. Interestingly, Aquinas has little to say about doubt. He arranges doubt on a spectrum together with opinion as one of several acts of the intellect that have unformed thought devoid of a firm assent. To doubt is to incline to neither side. To suspect is to incline to one side on slim grounds, and to opine is to incline to one side yet with fear or uncertainty. Opinion is a more interesting contrast to faith for him than is doubt, because it is closer to faith and therefore more revealing of faith's specific character. Nor does doubt receive treatment among the vices that are opposed to the virtue of faith. These are unbelief, blasphemy, and ignorance or dullness of mind. Only later would doubt come to seem like faith's natural antithesis. How can faith assent to its object with certainty when that object, God, can neither be seen nor known through demonstrative proofs? First, Aquinas grants that faith, while knowing God as first truth, does not know that first truth as it is in itself. For God is perfectly simple, and the human intellect knows by way of synthesis and analysis, knowing even simple objects in a complex way. Only in the beatific vision will it be possible to know God by simple understanding. Faith will then be displaced or perfected by sight. Faith assents to something not as in science because the object moves the intellect to assent, but because of an act of choice. Now, this seems odd to us because we typically regard doxastic attitudes, attitudes having to do with beliefs, as not the sort of thing we can make choices about. I can't choose to believe that 2 plus 2 equals 5, even if I could choose to write it or say it, nor can I choose to believe that the earth is flat. Beliefs are simply not subject to choice. I can indirectly work on my beliefs. I can join a flat earth cult, participate in their worship services, regularly expose myself to their conspiracy theories, their rants against modern science, and it is possible that I will come to believe that the earth is flat. But it would be odd to say in such a case that I had decided to believe that the earth is flat. Aquinas is well aware of this as he speaks of the person being moved to assent and explicitly dissents from the view that we move ourselves to assent to the things of faith by means of our free will prior to God's action on us. I'll return to that point in a moment. First, though, to the heart of the matter. How can faith be a sort of certainty since it does not see its object and lacks demonstrative proof of it? Because, Aquinas argues, faith assents to its object only because it is revealed by God. God, not a passionate leap, is the source of faith's certainty. Faith is thus less certain than science as regards its subject, the person who takes hold of matters of faith, but it is more certain than science as regards its cause, the Word of God. Importantly, the cause of faith is not our own reasoning. Aquinas recognizes that apologetic arguments, reasons employed, quote, by holy men to prove things that are of faith, end quote, are not demonstrative arguments. They are not rationally conclusive. Rather, they are, quote, either persuasive arguments showing that what is proposed to our faith is not impossible, or else they are proofs drawn from the principles of faith. So one can use arguments to clear a bit of room for faith or standing within faith. One can engage in the process that Anselm spoke of as faith seeking understanding. But neither of these human activities is capable of infusing the supernatural virtue of faith. Faith, then, assents to its object only because it is revealed by God, thereby arriving at a certainty exceeding that of science. Aquinas is happy to say that miracles may provide external inducement to assent to things of faith. However, such miracles no more provide sufficient cause for faith than do the apologetic arguments of theologians. Quote, of those who see the same miracle or who hear the same sermon, some believe and some do not, he says, rather matter-of-factly. His understanding of faith is thus poles apart from that of an evidentialist like Locke, who is concerned with identifying just how much and what sort of miraculous evidence is required in order rationally to assent to a truth above reason. For Aquinas, it is obvious that the evidence is, in human terms, insufficient. Nor does a leap of faith bridge the gap, as Kierkegaard, 6 centuries later, picking up on a hint from Gotthold Lessing, would suggest. Now, I hope that C. Stephen Evans will complicate that story, because I think it is more complicated. But we typically think about Kierkegaard as advocating that. Aquinas would think of this as falling into the heresy of Pelagianism. The Pelagians, Aquinas notes, held that it was human free will that led persons to assent to matters of faith. The human task is to be ready to assent to those things that are proposed to us by God. Since the readiness is what comes first, argues the Pelagians, the beginning of faith comes from ourselves. The consummation of faith comes from God. However, Aquinas argues, faith so understood would not be faith. It would not raise human beings above their nature. It would not direct them effectively to God as first truth. While faith does depend on the believer's will and act of assent, it is God who prepares the will and moves a person to assent. Faith then assents to God as first truth only because this truth is revealed by God and only by way of being moved to assent by God. In what sense then is this Dan or Sue's faith rather than God's faith? Has Aquinas made room for faith only by displacing human agency altogether? This is the point at which it's important to remind ourselves that faith is, after all, a virtue. And it's evident throughout Aquinas' treatment of the virtues that it's important to him to give an account of infused virtues as well as of acquired that preserves human agency. While the infused virtues are divinely infused, they are nevertheless given precisely as dispositions of human agency. They dispose a person's own will to God, and the human person remains the principle of movement, the agent of her acts. There are two features of Aquinas' take on the vices opposed to faith, of unbelief, including heresy and apostasy, blasphemy, and ignorance and dullness of mind, that are particularly worth noting from our vantage point. First, Aquinas seems, on the one hand, amazingly trusting that the teaching of the truth adequately conveys the first truth that is the object of faith, that is God. Hence, he's prepared to say, without hesitation, the teaching of the church must be adhered to as an infallible rule. Second, and on the other hand, by virtue of his recognition that faith is a divinely infused virtue, he is prepared to acknowledge that many forms of unbelief are not sinful. While it's clearly sinful knowingly to reject or oppose the truth, Aquinas identifies situation after situation in which knowing opposition ill describes the stance of the heretic or the unbeliever. He reminds us of the rabbis who honor a harsh biblical commandment by hedging it about with 1,000 qualifications. The stubborn and rebellious son should be stoned, of course, but only if he is no longer a child and not yet a man, is both a glutton and a drunkard, has stolen both meat and drink from his father's household and eaten it elsewhere, and has done so in the presence of other gluttons and drunkards. In conclusion, the Talmud tells us there has never been a stubborn and rebellious son and never will be. The point here is not that Aquinas is giving with one hand and taking away with the other. He did, in fact, trust the teaching of the church with regard to the first truth was to be trusted as an infallible rule. But he also recognized that there are unbelievers who have, as far as we can determine, not knowingly resisted or opposed the truth. It's not for us to judge whether they have been offered the virtue of faith. I'll lay this out in a little bit more detail because I think it's critical to making sense of how doubt can itself come to be regarded, and in some sense, properly so, as a virtue. There are seeds in Aquinas' discussion of unbelief that bear fruit only much later. Unbelief, taken as the pure absence of faith, is, Aquinas tells us, properly understood as punishment rather than sin. It's punishment because it's the result of original sin. Were it not for the fall, we would not find ourselves ignorant of divine things. The agency of the one who has never heard anything about the faith is not involved at all in her unbelief. She has not done anything to become an unbeliever. Hence Aquinas cautiously writes, quote, "If such like unbelievers are damned, it is on account of other sins, which cannot be taken away without faith, but not on account of their sin of unbelief." Elsewhere, he notes that ignorant unbelief has a certain reason for excuse. Unbelief becomes an actual sin when it involves opposition to the faith, refusing to hear it, or despising it. While faith is an infused virtue, not intrinsic to human nature, it is natural to love and accept the truth when we encounter it. Hence, to refuse or reject the truth is sinful. More specifically, it's a form of pride. pagans or heathen on his account resist the faith before it is accepted. Jews resist after having accepted the old law, the figure of faith. And heretics resist after the gospel of faith has been accepted. So they all sin because they're resisting the faith. While the heathen lie in the deepest error, heretics sin most grievously, since keeping a faith, once one is accepted, it is, in Aquinas' view, a matter of obligation. You have freely made a vow, a promise, to adhere to the faith, and it's proper, therefore, to compel heretics to keep their vow. Those who have never accepted the faith, including Jews who have accepted it only in figure, should never be compelled, since to believe depends on the will, and thus they should always be, quote, left free to believe, if indeed they will. While we might wish that Aquinas had stated the point more fully, the kernel of a familiar idea is present. To attempt to coerce faith results only in outward compliance, not real faith. Aquinas' understanding of heresy is shaped by its etymological roots in the Greek hieresis, choice. Aquinas regards heresy as the choice to adhere to one's own false opinion, to the suggestions of one's own mind, rather than to what Christ really taught. Its cause is thus pride. Only pride, he thinks, can account for why someone who has once embraced the truth and thus known the certainty of faith would depart from that truth to give preference to the suggestions of his or her own mind. We can conclude this very brief and incomplete exploration of the vices opposed to faith by considering blindness of mind and dullness of sense. Seems odd to name these as vices. And it quickly becomes clear that part of Aquinas' purpose in discussing them is to clarify that they are sinful only where culpable failure of attention is involved. For sometimes a person's will is deliberately turned away from the consideration of some principles, and sometimes the mind is more busy about things which it loves more. Such failures of attention are blameworthy. Aquinas joins to his affirmation of the necessity of human willingness to consider and embrace the truth, the confidence that God provides for each individual everything necessary for salvation. Even one raised by wolves in a forest away from humankind, favorite stock example up through the 18th century, would be given an interior inspiration by God that would reveal whatever is necessary, as long as the person herself places no obstacles in the way. At the same time, human willingness does not operate in a vacuum independent of God's grace. God does not coerce the will, but can change the will by bringing about a different inclination. The agent is no less freely moved by her own interior principle and is no less responsible for her acts. I've devoted so much time to discussing Aquinas' understanding of faith because I think there is much to be said for it, and in particular for an understanding of faith that is neither evidentialist nor voluntarist. At the same time, we can't share all of Thomas's assumptions. Leaping ahead now to the 16th and 17th centuries gives us the opportunity to consider, on the one hand, a creative extension of the Thomistic understanding of faith in the Spanish scholastic, and on the other, at the dawning of something radically new in Descartes and Locke. The thinkers of the Spanish scholastic offer an unrivaled opportunity to see how the Thomistic picture of faith shifts in subtle yet significant ways in a different social context. Descartes, in contrast, erects doubt rather than faith as a virtue, and I'll argue that it's the former rather than the latter that point the way forward. Francisco de Vitoria of the School of Salamanca, together with fellow Dominican Bartolomé de las Casas, officially appointed protector of the Indians for his advocacy on behalf of the Native Americans, argued that it was the Christian Europeans, not the natives, who were to blame if the natives did not enthusiastically embrace the Catholic faith. Drawing on Thomas's account of faith and unbelief, they sought to show that the natives were not culpable for their unbelief, even after the gospel had ostensibly been preached to them. For one could hardly expect them to be willing to consider and embrace teachings offered by those who had committed a host of atrocities against them. the problem wasn't dullness of sense, despite the claims of some who sought to depict the natives as Aristotle's natural slaves. The problem rested squarely with Christians, who had failed to consider that Native Americans had their own religious traditions supported by public authority, which rendered the erroneous tenets of those religions plausible. They would be obligated to embrace the Christian faith only if it became a genuine possibility for them, which would require the evidence of miracles or effective reasons to render it credible, or at least a blameless Christian life on the part of preachers. The conduct of Christians in the New World, invading and unjustly seizing domains and property, killing and slaughtering the inhabitants, had created an obstacle to faith that excused unbelievers. They remained in invincible ignorance. Importantly, they have never known the truth of the Christian faith. What they have resisted has not been that beautiful truth that is unnatural to reject, but a distorted, repellent image of that truth. Moreover, against those who insist that invincible ignorance cannot exist because God will grant an interior inspiration to anyone who does what is in him, Lascaux has argued that this is true only of those to whom God intends to give the grace of faith. Those who aren't predestined to salvation, quote, no matter how much they prepare themselves through free will or do what is in them, they will not attain grace, end quote. This isn't a sin or a fault of their own. Its ground lies in the mystery of God's will. At this point, Aquinas would demur slightly. If they are predestined for reprobation, they will not prepare themselves for faith. Further, they will be unwilling to believe. They will place an obstacle in the way of faith. Those predestined for salvation, in contrast, will place no such obstacles in the way. Nevertheless, Aquinas would agree with Las Casas about the possibility of unbelief that is not sinful. However, what for Aquinas, given his assumption that the gospel had been preached throughout the world, was merely a theoretical possibility, has become a vivid reality for Las Casas. In the face of a brave new world full of inhabitants to whom the gospel had never been preached, and whose reception of the gospel has now been tainted, perhaps permanently, by the depravities of their would-be converters, Las Casas is impressed not by the obligation to accept what God has revealed, but by the challenges of preaching the gospel where responsibility for the obstacles of faith, responsibility for the obstacles to faith clearly lies with believers, not with unbelievers. I focused on the impact of the discovery of the New World, but the Reformation was equally transformative. For this was to destabilize the argument that the obligation to accept what God has revealed could be mapped directly onto the obligation to adhere to the teaching of the Church as an infallible rule. For how are we to know that the teaching of this Church properly reflects what God has revealed? Las Casas reflects a version of this problem in his recognition that the religious traditions of the natives are probable in their eyes, just as Catholic teaching is probable in the eyes of those born and raised in the Catholic faith. Europeans were living with this same destabilization of religious authority right at home. Aquinas' epistemological innocence has been shattered. Yet a creative extension of his paradigm, one in which faith was a virtue, remained possible. This involved five elements. First, the recognition that justification is contextually relative, that what is probable to one need not be probable to another. Second, the accompanying recognition that despite this fact, human beings are capable of learning one another's languages and of exchanging reasons across radical cultural divides. Third, preserving Aquinas' insight that there is neither demonstrative argument nor evidence that is sufficient to make faith rationally necessary. Faith is not pure logic or science. Fourth, accepting that effective preaching is thus not a matter of demonstrative argument nor of conclusive, overwhelming evidence, but a radically holistic matter of the quality of one's whole character and life, which by being attractive or repellent can create or remove obstacles to others' faith. Lastly, faith is left finally in God's hands, as beyond the reach of human agency, even if it is a disposition indispensable to human flourishing. With Descartes, a decisive shift takes place. Passionate attention is directed to the problem of skepticism. Sincere a religious believer as he is in the process of bringing reason to the defense, not of the virtue of faith, but of the faith, Descartes erects doubt as a virtue. For Descartes is convinced that we must undertake to doubt everything in order to secure certainty about anything. Doubt is clearly an acquired, not an infused virtue. It is a disposition to be cultivated because it ultimately perfects us as believers. Only those who pass through the furnace of doubt purify their believings. Descartes' enterprise is not that of faith-seeking understanding, but of skepticism, of doubt-seeking certitude. The certainty that Descartes seeks is not the certainty that Aquinas recognizes in faith. Aquinas emphasized the uncertainty of faith on the part of its subject, the faithful person who cannot clearly see God as first truth, but who nevertheless trusts. For Descartes, the path through doubt leads to the subjective certainty of clear and distinct ideas, which simply is, in his eyes, certainty. The path of doubting everything leads to the cogito that establishes the self as beyond doubt. This self discovers its own finitude and imperfection, and so the contrasting idea of perfection that establishes the existence of God. But even as the content of the argument notes the dependence of the self on God, the form of the argument speaks more loudly of the self's autonomy. It is the doubter alone who has the power to justify belief in God. Infused faith is thus discredited. It is illegitimate, unjustified. Only those beliefs grounded in something certain are justified. Performing this grounding is the autonomous self whose glory is this task. Locke's evidentialism is, of course, in many respects significantly different from Descartes' rationalism. Yet both displace faith as trust and take belief to be in need of a certification that only autonomous human reason can provide. For Locke, the paradigm of knowledge is ideas of which we are immediately aware and the relations among them. From this immediate knowledge, we can come to know other propositions by demonstration. Everything else to which we assent, we believe rather than know. And we have a duty to believe only what is supported by evidence, and only as firmly as that evidence warrants. Religious faith belongs here. It is nothing but a firm assent of the mind. And if it be regulated, as it's our duty to do, it, quote, cannot be afforded to anything but upon good reason, end quote. Locke insists that when God, in his words, illuminates the mind with supernatural light, he does not extinguish that which is natural. If God wishes us to accept any religious proposition, he either evidences that truth, quote, by the usual methods of natural reason, or else makes it known to be a truth to which he would have us assent by his authority, and convinces us that it is from him by some marks in which reason cannot be mistaken, end quote. The evidence that Aquinas matter-of-factly noted could not constitute a sufficient cause of faith is now seen as the only legitimate pathway to faith. Faith is clearly not an infused virtue for Locke, not something for which we wait upon God. God reveals it is our responsibility to assess the evidence that God has done so and to regulate our believings accordingly. Whatever might be said in favor of a disposition to trust God, and the answer is not much, there is nothing to be praised about a disposition to trust that God has in fact revealed something, or that X, Y, or Z things have been revealed by God. What is to be praised is rather the proper execution of the gatekeeping duty that regulates our assent in proportion to the evidence. Belief is guilty until proven innocent. It's the disposition to doubt until the evidence has been properly assessed, that is now a virtue. And it is an autonomous human responsibility, not a gift from God. So with Descartes and Locke, the balance has tipped decisively. It's now doubt, not faith, that is a virtue, a humanly acquired virtue, a painstaking achievement, one that we have a duty to cultivate and that it is our dignity to uphold. This, by and large, remains the status quo in modernity, with religious faith on the defensive. Yet, with the collapse of foundationalism, the confidence that all of our beliefs can and therefore must be grounded in what is certain, the playing field is gradually leveled for religious belief. if the hard sciences cannot claim to be justified according to foundationalist strictures, if they too rest on premises that are simply assumed or taken on trust, why should religious believers hold themselves to its requirements? This is the important new moment that dawned in the late 20th century. But where exactly does it leave us? Locke worried that the alternative to his ethics of belief was anything goes, rampant enthusiasm, the proliferation of outlandish schemes. But I'd like in these closing minutes to suggest instead that it opens the possibility of a rehabilitation of the virtue of faith, now understood as having disposition to appropriate doubt built in. I'll do so in part by drawing on Karl Barth's account of Revelation, while picking up on the suggestions I sketched in connection with Las Casas and the transformation of Thomistic faith in the New World context. Barth, I want to suggest, helps us out at precisely the points where the epistemological innocence of Aquinas' understanding of faith is likely to make us uncomfortable. Recall Aquinas' insistence that the teaching of the Church must be adhered to as an infallible rule. This grows out of his confidence that the teaching of the Church adequately conveys the first truth, God, that is faith's object. But there's a huge gap between noting that faith assents to its object only because it's revealed by God, arriving thereby at a certainty exceeding that of science, and claiming that that same certainty attaches to what the Church teaches is taught by God. Like Aquinas, Barth emphasizes the Church as the site in which the Word of God is encountered. He also shares Aquinas' understanding of faith as believing something only because it has been revealed by God. But where Aquinas seems to idolize the Church and the transparency of its grasp of divine revelation, Barth underscores that all insight into God's revelation given to the Church by God is partial, incomplete, and provisional. The Church, he writes, has and receives through the Scriptures and the Spirit from generation to generation the truth which as God's truth is whole and unchangeable, but which as received and possessed by human beings is fragmentary and changeable, but still nonetheless truth. For Barth, faithfulness comes through a common hearing and receiving of the Word of God. The Word of God is mediated by the words of others. There's no immediacy in the reception of revelation. The Word of God is heard through the interplay of voices that make up the common deliberation of the Church, offering textually warranted interpretations of Scripture that are local and contextually responsive. This is a process in which all have the responsibility both to speak and to listen in order, through a process of mutual recognition, to arrive at a common confession of faith. This process is not an alternative to or complement to the reception of God's truth through the Spirit, but rather just is the reception of God's truth through the Spirit, a reception that is never once and for all, but always insight given for the moment. There is here a kind of forthright, unapologetic confidence, an insistence that Christian faith need not be ashamed of itself just because it does not live up to evidentialist standards that have, in any case, been discredited. On the other hand, there is still here an ethics of belief, just not one of evidentialist variety. The confession of faith is a process elicited by the recognition of error and confusion, and the task of naming error and confusion is an important element of common deliberation. The confession of faith must not be allowed to deteriorate into dogmatism. This is what happens when faith becomes hardened to change, deaf to the ongoing interplay of voices through which alone the Spirit is heard. Barth emphasizes the need to speak and to listen within the Church. But his frank acknowledgement that, in his own words, God may speak to us through Russian communism, a flute concerto, a blossoming shrub, or a dead dog, points the way to a further expansion of this ethics of belief. For the insistence that faith can be a virtue only when it's rooted in practices of giving and exchanging reasons, of listening to the naming of error and confusion, points in the direction already exemplified, at least in a kernel, by Bartolomé de las Casas. The responsibility both to speak and to listen, to exchange reasons, extends beyond the boundaries of our own communities of faith and identification. We cannot decide to believe or not to believe something. Belief is not subject to choice in this way. Moreover, our believings are innocent until proven guilty. We need not establish each on a firm evidentialist foundation in order to be justified in holding it. On the other hand, our beliefs do not remain innocent if we insulate them from critique. We have a responsibility to examine beliefs that are called into question and to implement practices that have the tendency, indirectly, to improve our believings. Following philosopher Nicholas Wolterstorff, we can dub these doxastic practices, practices that govern our belief dispositional constitution. We can do things like acquiring new experiences, reflecting on those we've already had, identifying and puzzling over inconsistencies, just the sort of thing that Las Casas began to do in the New World. Central among these doxastic practices is that of encountering the perspectives of others, listening to them, reflecting on the new light they shed on our own beliefs. Given the fact that, as Las Casas recognized, justification in believing, although not truth, is context relative, different people can be justified in believing different things. It's a complex matter to determine when someone is justified in believing something. Often we will find ourselves in situations in which we think that someone may be justified in believing something even though we are sure that they are wrong. Were we able to give them reasons for doubting what they believe, they might no longer be justified in believing it, but often we will not be able to find reasons of that sort. The same will be true for others in relationship to us. So very often our exchange of reasons with others, particularly with those of very different religious beliefs, will include heavy doses of simple acceptance of persistent radical difference. Importantly, this need not mean that anyone has failed in their doxastic practices. What then becomes of the virtue of faith? It's difficult today to make sense of a virtue being poured into the soul. And there are problems with simple dichotomies between natural and supernatural, nature and grace. Religious adherents are habituated into faith through their own actions and in the context of the social practices of their communities. But this natural process of the formation of virtue need not be seen either as competing with nor as excluding the operations of divine grace. Divine grace does not require a vacuum of human agency in order to work. This much is true of any virtue. But we may say further that faith in God, if God is, for example, who Christians have confessed God to be, is indeed, in a special sense, a grace-given virtue. A God who radically transcends creation and is not just one being alongside others in the world can be known only by way of God's application of human concepts to God's self. Identifying God's own self with these concepts, elevating them to a new use. Here I've learned from Kevin Hector, who himself is drawing on Barthes. Only if God indeed does so, only if God indeed does this, identification with our concepts in this way, does the disposition trustingly to employ such concepts result in true beliefs about God? The truth of faith, then, is not up to us in the sense that it is finally up to God to determine whether the dispositions that we have acquired to speak of and worship God in one way rather than another get God right, as it were. But we can be responsible for cultivating the acquired virtue of faith as a habit that governs our belief dispositional constitution, generally speaking. This virtue of faith is a stable habit of acting in ways that dispose us to acquire true beliefs, to trust the belief-forming practices of our communities, but also to experience more, to listen more, to identify inconsistencies, to learn who we can trust, to avoid the vices of prideful resistance and culpable failures of attention. There is then intrinsic to this virtue of faith the disposition to appropriate doubt, to doubt, to critically question where inconsistencies and nagging questions arise. Importantly, this virtue of faith is not Descartes' virtue of radical doubt, nor is it Locke's virtue of evidentialist gatekeeping. But neither is it a virtue of blind acceptance, of insulated credulity. In an important sense, then, faith and doubt stand as virtues only when they stand together. Isolated, they fall. Thank you.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you could repeat your definition of faith for us.
When did I define it?
Well, so toward the end, you said it was something like a.
So I said the virtue of faith is a stable habit of acting in ways that dispose us to acquire true beliefs, to trust the belief-forming practices of our communities, but also to kind of have the disposition to appropriate doubt as well.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, I guess that sounded pretty broad to me. I mean, I wondered if almost any responsible scientist or member of a philosophy department or something would. Mm-hmm. You know, who was seeking after truth in a responsible way would count as having faith, regardless of their attitudes toward religion. I had a couple things going on.
So that was the point at which I was saying, well, then this is acquired virtue of faith, and this is how we can describe it. But a little bit before that, I had talked about, what we would need to say to talk about faith in God. Right? So we may say further that faith in God, if God is who Christians have confessed God to be, is a grace-given virtue. So that's the point at which what I want to say is that even though I'd like to pull back from talking about faith as an infused virtue, I'm happy to talk about faith as a grace-given virtue in the sense that it's only if God identifies God's self with the concepts that we use in worshiping God, employing worshiping God, is it the case that faith gets God right? So I want to have that piece, but I'm also having this very broad, inclusive notion of acquired faith as well.
Thanks very much, everybody. I think we've reached the end of our discussion time. Thanks again, Professor Hirt, for sharing your wisdom with us. We're so glad you're here.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture from Jennifer Hirt, Gilbert L. Stark Professor of Christian Ethics and Associate Dean of Academic Affairs at Yale Divinity School. Professor Hirt's lecture was titled Faith and Doubt Among the Virtues and was presented by the Boston University Institute for Philosophy and Religion. Tonight's moderator was Institute for Philosophy and Religion Director David Eckel. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Ian McCarn. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydonis. I'm Jack Lepiars. Thanks for joining us.